my friends. Welcome to the Addiction Medicine Made Easy podcast, where we take topics in addiction medicine and break them down into digestible nuggets and clinical pearls that you can use at the bedside. Dr. Casey Grover here as your host once again. And just in case you missed our episode explaining the name change, Addiction Medicine Made Easy is the new name for the Addiction in Emergency Medicine and Acute Care podcast. Now, before we get started on this episode, I wanted to share something in addiction medicine that has been on my mind. A study just came out looking at the relationship between cannabis use and anxiety. The study was published in eClinical Medicine in 2024 with Daniel Myron as the lead author. The study was entitled Development of an Anxiety Disorder Following an Emergency Department Visit Due to Cannabis Use, a Population-Based Cohort Study. Here are some key findings. For patients who have an emergency department visit related to cannabis use, the likelihood of being diagnosed with an anxiety disorder is 4 times higher than that for the general population. A whopping 27% of patients who had an emergency department visit related to cannabis use were diagnosed with an anxiety disorder within 3 years of that emergency department visit. And for patients who have an emergency department visit related to cannabis use, the risk of a subsequent hospitalization or emergency department visit for an anxiety disorder is 9 times higher than that of the general population. My take home from this is that regular, heavy cannabis use increases anxiety and the risk of being diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. This is so important for our patients to know and for us to know, as many of our patients are self-medicating with cannabis. Okay, on to today's episode. Today's episode is on what is coming next in the illicit drug supply. Here's the backstory on this episode. I was asked to prepare this lecture for our local firefighters. I live and work in Monterey, California, and the Monterey Fire Department asked me to train their firefighters and medics on what is coming next in the illicit drug supply. They have heard about fentanyl analogs and xylazine, and the firefighters wanted to make sure that they are well informed about what illicit substances are coming into the drug supply and how to respond to overdoses on these novel illicit substances. So, I prepared this lecture. We cover the history of how the illicit drug supply changed from plant-based drugs to synthetic research chemicals, what novel substances are being detected in the drug supply, and how to respond to overdoses with an illicit drug supply that is increasingly made up of synthetic drugs and research chemicals. I recorded this while I was giving the lecture using my iPhone. I apologize for some background noise. The firefighters had to keep their radios on while I was speaking. Here we go. All right, so I think I know most everybody from the ER, Dr. Grover from the ER, been in the ER chomp for about 11 years, and then I just started doing addiction medicine formally in the last year, and I'm here today to paint an extremely bleak picture of what's coming next in the drug supply. I wish I have good news, but I don't. We're going to start with a little bit of history, because I feel like the why as to why all these research chemicals are ending up in our drug supply is very informative, and it helps kind of understand the various factors that have gotten us to this moment. So we're going to do a little kind of course through history on kind of the drug market and the kind of the different trends in opiates in America, and then we'll get into atezolam and isotretinoin and all these kind of drugs coming next in the drug supply. So, to start, this is one of my favorite books. It's called Dreamland by Sam Quiñones, and this is the first book that was really a good look at the opiate crisis in America. And so, he really was the first one to take on prescription pills and heroin, and I'm going to give you the cliff notes. It's a great listen on Audible as well. So, traditionally, Americans really didn't take opiates. The average American took less than one opiate tablet a year going back to the 1950s. And in the 1980s, doctors started to be told that, hey, there's an epidemic of chronic pain. We've got to do more. We've got to do better.
So doctors started being told, like, practice better medicine around pain. Originally, it was really multidisciplinary. You saw a psychologist, you saw a nutritionist, you got physical therapy, and they gave you a little bit of opioid medication. And it turns out that it was expensive, and ultimately insurance companies just really wanted to pay for meds. All of a sudden now, there's an epidemic of chronic pain. We've got to do better. Pain's a vital sign. What's your pain from 0 to 10? And ultimately, we kind of missed the mark. We gave everybody opiates, and it really did not go well. This is an original advertisement from OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, right? So when I was starting talking about this, nobody had heard of the Sackler family or Purdue Pharma. Now it's people know DopeSick. So this is an original ad from OxyContin. I love this. Your doctor might prescribe an opioid medication. Less than 1% of patients become addicted. And this is what we got. Like, this was the best information we had. I am now going to show you the entire world's literature that Purdue Pharma used to support this claim. You ready? Porter and Jick, New England Journal of Medicine, 1980, addiction rare in patients treated with narcotics. Okay, here is the entire article, all 11 lines. I mean, middle school science fair experiments have more rigor than this. And poor Dr. Jick has come back and just said, I am so sorry. I had no idea that this one little random letter to the editor was going to change drugs for the world, essentially. And yeah, you can see how long I've been doing this. I last looked in 2016, and this article has been cited by other researchers over 900 times. That one little 11-line letter to the editor. So this brings us to the fact that we really had several different waves in our opiate crisis. So the way I think of it, we basically had three waves. We had prescription pills. We then had heroin. And now we have fentanyl. And actually, some argue that there's even a fourth wave of mixing opiates and stimulants, but we'll come back to that. Just to get a sense of how bad things got in that first wave around prescription meds, this is a great book, American Pain, and this is real. This is the story of opiates in Broward County, Florida. So it turns out that Florida had a lot less regulations around prescription meds. And so it turns out that Florida at one point was distributing 9 times more OxyContin than the rest of America combined. These two brothers you can see on the screen are both convicted felons, and they ran a pain clinic run by doctors whose licenses had kind of disciplinary actions against them. They were making $14 million a year cash. They literally had trash bins of cash that they would, like at the front desk, you'd pay and they just throw it in the trash bin. They did not have medical assistants or nurses. They had strippers. This book, American Pain, outlines what happened. And unfortunately, it was a total free-for-all during the 2000s and early 2010s of just pills, pills, pills. And this is just a great book that kind of documents that one time in history and the law enforcement actions to take down these two guys. This is a testament to just how bad it got with prescription pills being sold on the street. This is a website called streetrx.com. You can price check what you're buying on the street. Adderall in Las Vegas was $5. Oxycodone in Jacksonville was $5. Ativan in New Jersey was $5. Last time I checked a few months ago, the website was still active. Tylenol number 3, so Tylenol with codeine. Yeah, Tylenol with codeine was $75 a pill. That is not a good deal. Yeah. So yeah. So again, this brings us to the fact that that was wave one. Okay, so I am part of the problem as a doctor in going from wave one to wave two. Okay, so what do we do as healthcare providers when we identify our patient has a problem? We tell them to stop, right? Hey, doc, you know, you've got a problem with opioids. I think you should stop. Unfortunately, what we missed is the phenomenon of drug dependence. So somebody takes an opioid every day. When they stop, their body is now out of balance and they go into withdrawal. So people would come in. They'd be like, I feel horrible. I'm in horrible pain. And we'd say, sorry, you've got a problem with your pain meds. I can't prescribe any more for you. We really missed the fact that people were withdrawing from opiates. I met a guy in Salinas who was a bull rider. So he takes horns to the ribs, breaks his ribs. They gave him oxycodone, an opiate, for 6 weeks while his ribs healed. And 6 weeks after daily oxycodone, they were like, hey, you're healed. And he went into horrible opiate withdrawal when they cut him off. And he kept going back and being like, something's not right. I feel so horrible. And eventually he realized he was in opiate withdrawal and found heroin because that was the only thing he could get. And he kept going to doctors and they said, you're addicted. We can't prescribe for you. Now, fast forward 10 years later, now as a doctor, I'm now as an addiction doctor, I help people get off of opiates all the time. There's actually some great treatments, methadone, Suboxone. I mean, I just saw a patient 45 minutes ago that 3 weeks ago was using fentanyl and is now on Suboxone. No cravings, no withdrawal. She's going to get a job this week. So if we had learned in wave one that we needed to treat dependence and addiction, we may have avoided the move to wave two. But since we're here, let's talk about what happened. Wave two. Oh, this is before we get there, this is a great graphic of how the American Society of Addiction Medicine kind of describes what using opiates is like. The first few times you use, you go from normal to feeling euphoric. We also have to address the phenomenon of tolerance. People mostly know with alcohol, right? If you drink a lot, you can hold your liquor. Same thing with opiates, the more you use, the more the body gets used to it. So most patients start here saying, oh, my first couple of doses, wow, that felt really good, I want to use more. Eventually, they just can't get back up there as the brain tries to stay in balance. Eventually, over time, they get to where they only really feel withdrawal and the opiate just gets them back into not feeling withdrawal. I mean, some of my patients haven't been high in years. And this is, again, where Suboxone is so helpful or methadone is so helpful. It's because we just treat the withdrawal and then they don't have to worry about constantly trying to get opiates. Anyways, on to heroin. I am a total geek about this stuff. This slide makes me smile every time I show it. American Journal of Pharmacy, December 1901. Bayer Pharmaceutical Products, heroin. Anyone know another drug that Bayer makes? Aspirin, yes. From the makers of aspirin, it's heroin. This was brought to market as a cough medicine in the late 1800s. Okay, this slide is even better. This makes me smile even more. From the makers of aspirin, introducing heroin for the non-addictive relief of cough since 1898. I love this. Makes me smile every time. So there's some history here. So it turns out that in the Civil War, we did have access to morphine. And unfortunately, a lot of soldiers with their injuries got addicted to morphine, whether it's dependence, where they take it daily and get withdrawal when they stop, or addiction, again, the psychological craving. So opiate addiction from morphine was so common after the Civil War that they actually called opiate addiction soldiers' disease. And there were various things that were tried to help treat these soldiers, one of which was Coca-Cola, right? If morphine's addictive, the combination of sugar, caffeine, and cocaine maybe is enough to stop using opiates. That didn't really pan out. The other one is Bayer Pharmaceuticals brought this miracle new non-addictive opiate to market called heroin. Literally, we did this in the 1800s. We tried a miracle non-addictive opioid called heroin to treat opiate addiction. That didn't work. Fast forward 120 years, we had a miracle non-addictive opioid called OxyContin, except that was addictive. So history tends to repeat itself, and I always find this story of heroin so interesting. So let's talk a little bit about heroin. This is the first trend we're going to talk about today, is that the market is changing from plant-based drugs to synthetic lab-based drugs. This is a picture of an opium poppy field. It's like another crop, right? Opium poppy gets refined into make heroin. You need land, you need sunshine, you need people, and you need law enforcement to avoid burning your crop. In other words, it's a lot of work to produce plant-based drugs. And that has really been the push from wave two to wave three. Wave three is the arrival of the synthetics. So really fentanyl has become the dominant opioid, and I'll walk you through exactly why. So fentanyl, in terms of the history, was synthesized in the 1960s as a better opioid around surgery because it was so strong. So fentanyl, and this used to be kind of new information for folks, but now it's It's, I think most people are familiar. Fentanyl is about 100 times stronger than morphine, just for reference. Very useful, synthesized in a lab. And then you can imagine trying to choke the drug supply is hard because we need it as healthcare providers. There's an interesting phenomenon that we talk about in addiction medicine called the iron law of prohibition. And the iron law of prohibition is that when you make a substance illegal, people will find a way to smuggle it in ever more potent forms. It's just easier. If you're going to take the legal risk, you might as well get more money with what you smuggle. So during prohibition of alcohol in the United States, many Americans actually drank more. And most Americans prior to prohibition drank beer and wine. Subsequent to prohibition, they drank whiskey and moonshine. It's just more alcohol for the same volume, so you can make more money if you're going to smuggle it. And that's the same phenomenon with fentanyl. So let's actually go through exactly what that math is, okay? So the therapeutic dose of fentanyl is 100 micrograms. That's maybe a little heavy. I usually dose around 50 micrograms. And the fatal dose of fentanyl is 2 milligrams. A sugar packet, I'm sure we have one around here somewhere, a sugar packet usually contains 4 grams of sugar. So if we take this sugar packet, dump out the sugar, and fill it up with fentanyl, that's enough for me to treat 40,000 patients. 40,000. So you can imagine if you can smuggle a shoebox of heroin or morphine or a single sugar packet, it's just easier to smuggle. This goes back to the iron law of prohibition. And as I put up there, turns out you can mail up to 112 grams in a letter. Which brings us to the next part of this story. This is another great book called American Kingpin that describes the next phase. Okay? American Kingpin is about a physics student named Ross Ulbricht, who was a libertarian. He believed that people should get to do whatever they want. You want to use drugs? You should be able to use drugs. So he created a website called The Silk Road. And this is actually a screenshot from The Silk Road. He essentially created anonymous online eBay for drugs. They used a part of the internet called the dark web, which is all anonymous browsing using a browser called Tor, T-O-R. And you can see here, LSD, Soma, Afghan heroin, cocaine, Ativan, amphetamine, mushrooms. You could literally anonymously go online and order your drugs and they would be delivered to you, UPS, FedEx, US Postal Service. And if you're wondering, this is just around the time that cryptocurrency arrived. So now, in addition to being able to browse and buy anonymously, people could make purchases anonymously too. And the story continues. We also are now finding that a lot of pharmaceutical companies are selling direct to consumers. I literally Googled buy fentanyl online and I found this website from Quality Chem Lab in no less than 30 seconds. Fentanyl powder, $280 to $1,900 depending on how much you buy. Now don't forget, this is an international purchase. Most of these are drug labs in Asia. And again, take a look here on the screen. This is being sold as a research chemical. A lot of my patients call these RCs. So essentially now, what we're finding is that drugs have shifted from person-to-person dealing, and now we're seeing online kind of delivery-based drugs. The story continues. This is, and I'll explain the Oprah reference in just one second, but this is a list in 2018 of all the different kind of chemical cousins of fentanyl that the DEA seized. And fentanyl, because it's made in a lab, you can just add in a methyl group or a furanyl group or an acetyl group. What we're seeing now, and we don't know anything about these. I don't know anything about furanyl fentanyl. It was never meant for human consumption. A lot of these drugs were synthesized, found to have poor safety profiles, shelved just as like a in like a repository, never meant to be used for human consumption. Now they're coming back into the drug market. Again, they're sold as research chemicals. We don't know much about them. The Oprah reference is, if anyone remembers, 15 years ago, Oprah gave everyone in the audience a car. You get a car, you get a car. Anyways, I found this meme online. You get a fentanyl analog, you get a fentanyl analog. Anyways, okay. Addiction geek humor. Sorry, I guess it wasn't funny. Okay. Kind of following along that same vein, when I searched for Buy Fentanyl Online, I found this website, Buy Fentanyl Powder Online, Furanyl Fentanyl Powder. An opioid analgesic is a fentanyl analog and available as a research chemical. The product is 99.9% pure, and you can pay on WhatsApp. This is where the market is going, is basically online, kind of direct-to-consumer purchases. The trend is also seen in meth. So this is a great article. Remember that first book I showed you, Dreamland? The author is Sam Quiñones. He also wrote this article. It's called, I Don't Know That I Would Even Call It Meth Anymore. So, turns out that meth can be made from various production pathways. One of them uses a precursor chemical called ephedra. Ephedra is plant-based. It used to be kind of a common workout supplement. So it turns out that ephedra, when it's used to make meth, makes a certain amount of a certain potency. People in the illicit drug industry found that if you used a different pathway, you could increase the potency and the product by like tenfold. And that method is called P2P. And that's just the name for the chemicals that they use. So between like 2014 and 2016 in California, the meth shifted from ephedra-based to P2P-based. And what we found is that the price of meth dropped 90%, the potency of meth jumped, and meth started to behave differently. You guys all know meth now, right? Paranoid, taking apart bikes, trying to make like a supercomputer between your cell phone and your computer. That kind of disassembling, assembling behavior is called punding. And it's very common with this type of meth. What's really hard, because it's so much more potent and it's cheaper, so people can use so much more of it, that we're just seeing so much more mental health problems from this P2P meth. And what's really hard in my practice is people will hear voices on meth for 6 months, 12 months, even longer. It's really getting hard to differentiate what's schizophrenia and what's related to meth. But same phenomenon, we're seeing it going from plant-based to lab synthetic, and then the amount that can be produced going up just crazy amounts. Okay, so this is from a colleague of mine in Oakland. We're really in a worst case scenario, right? We as doctors flooded the market with our patients with prescription opioids. We didn't offer treatment, and now the market's being flooded with high potency research chemicals, methamphetamine, fentanyl. Really, really kind of a very dark, dark landscape we're in. So I'm going to go through some data to show kind of some of the trends that we're seeing, and then we'll get into like actually specific which drugs I'm worried about are going to be coming into the population next. So this is a graphic from the California Opioid Dashboard. So here in California, our public health department runs a database looking at overdoses, and we can trend this stuff over time. So this first graphic is looking at the number of opioid prescriptions per patient in a particular community. And you can take a look from 2012 to 2022, prescriptions of opioids have dropped by over 50%. So as doctors, we're trying to be safer. We're cutting back. Here's the problem. This next graph is looking at opioid overdose deaths in the population during the same time period. And the graph looks exactly the opposite, right? Opiate overdoses have over doubled in California during that same time period when doctors were prescribing less opioids. So really most of our overdoses now, as I'm sure you're seeing as well, it's all illicits. Yeah. So you can take a look here in Monterey County. We started working on this in 2013, and our overdose death rate dropped below the California state average. At one point, we were the second lowest county in the state on opiate overdoses per capita. And a lot of it is what we've been doing. Getting Narcan out there, talking to kids, trying to get more drug treatment available. So you can see when fentanyl arrived in 2019, California spiked more than Monterey County, largely because we'd already been working a lot on opiates and addiction, and we were able to maybe prevent some of the other overdoses that other counties were seeing that weren't as prepared. I mean, my estimate is we've given out over 10,000 doses of Narcan in Monterey County in the last 10 years. Yeah, we really wanted to prepare for this. Okay, This next graphic is looking at fentanyl overdose deaths per capita. You can see 2019 is really when it hit us here in Monterey County. In fact, I remember it was October 2019. I don't know if anyone was working, but it was a weekend. My spouse, who's another addiction doctor, and I were in Lake Tahoe, and we got 10 overdoses in our ER that weekend on fentanyl. And everybody was like, what is this? It was new. We didn't know what was happening. 2019 is when fentanyl hit us. You can see in California, it probably hit a little bit earlier. But overall, the trends are that fentanyl overdoses are continuing to rise in both. Here in Monterey, we peaked a little bit in 2020 with the pandemic stressors, came down a little bit, but we're seeing just so much fentanyl coming into the county that overdoses are on the rise again. And then remember I mentioned that maybe there's that fourth wave of the opiate crisis? Some people are suggesting that the fourth wave is the mix of opioids and stimulants. And we'll talk about that specifically in just a little bit. But this is a graphic looking at the trends of deaths when opiates and stimulants are mixed. And you can see in California, it's been going up for quite a bit of time. We've been kind of up and down a little bit. But take a look at this from 22 to 23, you know, our overdose death rate when opiates and stimulants combined is really spiking. So yeah, so that's kind of the data that we're seeing. Okay, so what are we doing to try to figure out what's in the drug supply? So the first is we reached out to the San Francisco coroner's office. They have a toxicology lab. So if we get a weird overdose, we will literally send blood and urine up to San Francisco for analysis. They are detecting about 2 new drugs a week in the drug supply. Some of these are these old research chemicals. Some of these are novel substances that are newly synthesized. It's a bit of a free-for-all. But this is a paper we published from our emergency department in the Journal of Public Health Research in 2023. Recognize my name as one of the authors. We literally have a handheld scanning device for our ER to scan drugs that come through the ER. So I was working, I can't remember when, and one of the ICU nurses comes out of the ICU and she's like, "Hey doc, this patient's acting weird and we found some white powder in his room. Can you scan it?" I'm like, "Sure." So I literally, it's a laser and it basically bounces light into the product. And then based on what comes back, it's able to see what kind of known chemical it matches with. It's called Raman spectrometry. And in this particular case, somehow this patient had gotten cocaine into the ICU. Yeah. So this is actually our data from our hospital from about 18 months ending in 2022. So you can see on the left here, we have all the drugs we detected. Methamphetamine was number 1, then cocaine, then fentanyl. We detected acryl fentanyl 3 times. I don't really know what that is. It's some sort of fentanyl. We don't know if it's stronger or weaker than fentanyl. Heroin, which I thought was essentially gone on there. Amphetamine, Valium, Atizolam, that's a benzo that no one's ever heard of that we're going to talk about in a sec. And then acetylfentanyl. You can also see on the right, these are all the cutting agents. So, I mean, the drug supply has been tainted for years, right? You're a dealer, you want to double your profit. Take your product, divide it in half, and add in a powder of the same color. Like when I talk to students about, like, how do drugs get made? I'm like, does anyone have any white substances in their home? And the kids are like, oh, baking soda, laundry detergent. I'm like, it's not rocket science. It's literally color matching. So you can see the stuff that gets mixed in. Mannitol, aspirin, lactose, caffeine, cellulose, Epsom salts, Benadryl, Naprosyn, all that stuff is still there. This is more of an older phenomenon, but again, seeing these acryl fentanyl, atizolam, acetylfentanyl, these new molecules is different. Okay, so we are now going to look kind of substance by substance at what I think is coming next. And then we'll talk about kind of how to stay safe in the era of fentanyl. And then we'll have some time for questions. So we're going to start with benzos, because I think this is interesting because this is a newer phenomenon. So this is an article from the CDC that was published in 2021. And this was kind of like raising the flag of awareness of like, uh-oh, we're detecting some new benzos no one's ever heard of in emergency departments. The two that we've detected here initially... One is called atizolam. It's a benzo that was kind of synthesized and not found to be safe for humans. So it was shelved as a chemical, as a research chemical. It's coming back in. Atezolam we have detected at our hospital. You guys know those blue M30 tablets? I think it was PGPD brought in those tablets and was like, yeah, I got some fentanyl. And they scanned it with our device. No fentanyl. Just atezolam. This one is flualprazolam. You guys probably recognize the name alprazolam. That's generic for Xanax. This is basically another side group on that. This was an interesting one. This lady went online and found a website that sells research chemicals. So she ordered it. It came next day air. She drank the bottle and ended up in our emergency department after having had an overdose. I still have the bottle on my desk. I saved it. Literally next day drug delivery online. This one is called bromazolam. This one we have seen here as well. And there's kind of two phenomena here. One is somebody says, hey, I've got, insert name of real med. I've got some Xanax. I've got some Valium. And it's not, it's this. Some dealers are also just selling this as the name bromazolam, just saying it's a really strong benzo. And patients know they want benzos. So this is some national data. These are the different states it was detected in. And you can see how regional it is. There's a lot of detections in Texas, Tennessee, and Pennsylvania, and none in Montana. And that's really kind of the trend in drugs, is it's very regional. So what we have in Monterey is a little different than Salinas. What we have in Monterey is a little bit different than Los Angeles or Santa Cruz. And state to state, it varies. This study was saying that they were finding that as many as 10% of fentanyl in some areas was co-mixed with this benzo bromazolam. The other addiction doctor, Dr. Close, who again, that's my spouse, has one patient that, or I think two patients that used this. One of them ended up with a lot of mental health side effects, a lot of paranoia, a lot of hallucinations, which we don't normally see with benzos. And that's kind of our thought is, well, that's why it never went to market as a legit med, is because it had some nasty mental health side effects. So it's out there. We've seen it a handful. We haven't seen it a lot, but it's here. This is from the DEA in 2023, and this is a listing of five benzos that were previously not considered scheduled drugs. So law enforcement wasn't monitoring them as a controlled substance, but these are the names. You'll recognize two of them. Atezolam, flualprazolam, clonazolam, flubromazolam, and diclazepam. What do we know about those? They're benzos. How strong are they? We don't know. But again, what we're seeing is law enforcement is trying to catch up with these research chemicals, designate them as scheduled so they can go after them. But it's, as we all know, it's like whack-a-mole. I mean, there's so many research chemicals out there, new syntheses happening. As far as benzo overdoses, you've probably seen people overdose on Valium, Ativan. What do we see? The predominance is they get really sedated. Benzos are less likely to cause respiratory depression than other overdoses. If you take enough of them, you can. You can also get bradycardic and hypotensive. There is a reversal agent that exists for benzos called flumazenil. We really almost never use it. And the reason is if somebody's using benzos regularly, they're dependent, one of the symptoms of benzo withdrawal is seizures, right? So you give a benzo blocker, flumazenil, they go into withdrawal, they seize. When you try to give benzos back to treat their seizures, they don't work because the benzos are blocked. So really in the hospital, we give this like very rarely, usually like somebody gets too sedated after surgery, after a single dose. So you can know that flumazenil exists, but we really don't use it much. Unfortunately, the treatment for benzo overdose is supportive, right? If they're hypotensive, give them fluids. Sometimes we use like a pressor to bring up their blood pressure. If they need to be intubated because their mental status is too depressed, we can do that, but it's all supportive. They just have to metabolize. However, as I mentioned, a lot of times these new substances are going to be co-laced with fentanyl, so a dose of naloxone or even several is always appropriate. All right. Okay. Moving on to fentanyl. So this is, and I know we're all experts in chemistry, so we can read all these molecular structures. This is a list of, I think, 17 different chemical structures that are all variations on the basic fentanyl backbone. Brifentanyl, remifentanyl, trifentanyl, mirfentanyl, furanyl fentanyl, butyryl fentanyl. fentanyl is actually really easy to manipulate, which means that we're going to see a lot more of these. On this list, the ones we've talked about, acetyl fentanyl, we've detected that here. Carfentanyl, we're going to come back to, but this is really what worries me. It is so easy to make these chemical analogs of fentanyl that I'm worried that one of these is going to become the dominant drug in the near future. We don't know yet. I mentioned carfentanyl. Let's specifically look at carfentanyl. So this graphic you've seen before, and if you Google heroin, fentanyl, carfentanyl, this graphic usually comes up as the number one hit. But these are three vials, each about the size of your thumb, that shows the fatal amount of each of these three opioids. On the left is heroin. You can see it's a moderate kind of powder, so a pretty decent amount to kill someone. In the middle, what is that, like 50 grains of fentanyl is a lethal dose in an adult. Look all the way to the right, carfentanyl. It is a single grain is enough to kill an adult. If you're wondering, carfentanyl was never meant to be used in humans. It is to tranquilize elephants, truly. Now, I have been in contact with two people in this area that have sought out carfentanyl recreationally. Basically, what happens is they use fentanyl. Their tolerance goes up. They're constantly trying to get more. I mean, some of my patients are using fentanyl like 50 plus times a day. They have actually sought out carfentanyl because it's stronger. And that's kind of this trap of opiates. Remember that graph with the squiggly lines? People get into it thinking they're going to be euphoric, and by the end, they're just trying to stay out of withdrawal. So carfentanyl is interesting. We were meeting with a drug testing company that does like urine drug tests in Southern California, and they had an interesting phenomenon. I don't know the time frame on this, but they said that urine drug tests were positive for fentanyl, and then they saw a switch that all of a sudden fentanyl was gone, and now it was carfentanyl. And then over a period of months, the carfentanyl went away and the fentanyl came back. And their hypothesis was that because carfentanyl is so much stronger, the dealers were killing too many people. And they were like, that's it. We're just killing too many customers. We've got to go back to fentanyl. So interestingly, we've seen carfentanyl kind of come in and out of some drug markets. Here right now in the Central Coast, it's very sporadic. It's like maybe a handful of folks are using it and they're having to seek it out. But it's here. This is from my office. So this is one of the things we're also doing to try to see what's going on in the drug supply. So we asked our lab manufacturer to test for some of these fentanyl analogs. So I'm routinely testing in the office for perfluorofentanyl, carfentanyl, acrylfentanyl, furanylfentanyl, acetylfentanyl, and xylazine, which we'll come back to. But yeah, this is one of my patients from last week. You can see her fentanyl level is too high to detect. She's been taking a lot of fentanyl. And she tested positive for acetylfentanyl. Again, what do we know about these fentanyl cousins? Some of them we know are stronger, like carfentanyl. Some of these we really don't, like furanylfentanyl. Okay, so next on the list is ISO. And this is interesting. This is really regional. When I talk to other colleagues, they're like, what's ISO? I haven't heard of it. So this refers to a drug called isotonidazine. This is an opioid that no one's heard of. This is a class of opioids that is different than morphine and heroin, different than fentanyl. It's in its own class. Okay? What do we know about it? Not much. It's about the same strength as fentanyl. And here's what really kind of pisses me off about the drug landscape right now. I obviously wanted to give you guys the best information I could, so I kept searching for isotonidazine. This is all I could find. This is an ad from Asia to sell you isotonidazine, right? They have an email. You can get on WhatsApp, Telegram, Skype. You can supply 500 kilograms a week of this stuff. So this is really unfortunate. We are now, it is easier to buy drugs than for us as doctors to get good information about it. Now in this class, there are three others. So a cousin of isotonidazine is also etonidazine. There's also metonidazine and clonidazine. What do we know about them? I don't know. Yeah, that's kind of the same trend in this part of the presentation is it's really weird. There's all these chemicals. We don't know that much about them. But from an overdose standpoint, an opiate is an opiate, right? So if somebody has an opiate overdose, you're going to look for the same stuff. It's going to work. Yeah. So yes, you're going to look for pinpoint pupils, respiratory depression, altered mental status, and the treatment is naloxone and lots of it. As the drugs get more potent, you may need to give more doses. So for, you know, heroin, they might have needed one Narcan. For, you know, carfentanil, they might need six.
Do you think this will, spur a change in, expanding how much Narcan we can give in the field? Or do you think that'll kind of remain the same?
Yeah, great question. I don't know how this will affect public policy. But my assumption is as the drug supply gets more tainted, I think we'll all just realize we need more. Getting a base consult to be like, I got some weird overdose. Can I get more Narcan? I mean, absolutely. Yeah. All right. And next we have Trenk. Xylazine. This is a picture from the CHOMP ER about 3 or 4 months ago. Those are my hands in those photos. So this was a patient who came in and he brought in a blue pill. And he's like, Doc, I'm withdrawing from fentanyl. I feel horrible. We actually ended up admitting him. And this is the drug he brought with him. You can see they're basically small little chalky blue pill fragments. I took it with our handheld Raman spectrometer and tested it. I got nothing. Turns out this is xylazine. So xylazine, the street name is Trenk. It's here. And we've had a couple of our patients test positive for it. So let's go through it. So what xylazine is it's used in veterinary medicine to tranquilize animals. It is similar to a human medicine, clonidine. You guys probably recognize clonidine because we use it to treat high blood pressure. The way clonidine works is it takes the stress hormones in the brain, like adrenaline, norepinephrine, and reduces how much of them get to the rest of the body. So you can imagine, if you're not as stimulated, your heart rate's going to drop, your blood pressure's going to drop, your mental status is going to drop. Clonidine in humans, we actually use to treat opiate withdrawal, because opiate withdrawal is like a hyper-stimulated state of these stress hormones. So xylazine and clonidine are cousins. So interestingly, we use clonidine to treat opiate withdrawal, and that's actually why xylazine's being mixed into the drug supply is it makes the withdrawal from opiates not as bad. So for people using fentanyl, they don't feel like they withdraw as often. There is a reversal agent for this drug, xylazine, in animals, but there is not one in humans. You can imagine as it decreases the stress hormones going to the body, you're going to see decreased level of consciousness, bradycardia, and hypotension in the case of an overdose. You can also get respiratory depression as well. The other thing people have heard about is wounds. So essentially with chronic use of xylazine, the effects on the blood flow to the arms and the legs basically means that the arms and the legs don't get enough blood. And then eventually, unfortunately, you start to get these wounds due to decreased blood supply. Treatment, unfortunately, is really just supportive. Now, that being said, most often xylazine is going to be mixed with fentanyl. So absolutely give naloxone. So yeah, I mean, as far as supportive care, they need to be intubated, intubate them. If they're hypotensive, give them fluids. We may need to start pressors by the time they get to the hospital. All right, a couple more points here, and then we'll have some time to discuss and kind of go through questions. So this is a really interesting study, and this looks at how often stimulants are laced with fentanyl. So I have an addiction medicine podcast. I just covered this paper. It was really interesting. So it turns out that there are programs where if you're using drugs and you want to find out what your dealer's selling you, you can pay $100 and mail it. And then these labs will test your drugs and send you back the results. So they literally said, well, hey, we're testing the drugs anyways. Why don't we find out how often cocaine and methamphetamine are laced with fentanyl? And the answer is as many as 20% of the time. Now, here in our area, I think this is higher. Most of my patients that use meth have like a low-level fentanyl that tests positive on their urine drug test. Now, is that intentional or just kind of cross-contamination? A little bit hard to know. We are also seeing here, and I don't know if any of you guys have run on them, where a person who is not used to taking opiates buys cocaine or meth and they use it and they promptly have an opiate overdose. We give them like 6 doses of Narcan, and when they get to us in the ER, we test them and they're negative for cocaine or meth and they're positive for fentanyl. So that is also a trend that we're seeing where the dealer's just like, you know, I don't really care. I'm going to sell you what I've got and tell you what you want to buy. So that's another thing that we're seeing as well. So to summarize, in 2024, when responding to overdoses, drug supply is changing. We don't necessarily know what's in it. And the dealers probably don't necessarily know as well. This trend of everything going to synthetic and research chemicals and lab-based seems to be here to stay. Treatment is largely supportive care and lots of naloxone. And I'm worried about what's coming next.
And that is the end of this episode. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for what you do. And don't forget, treating substance use disorders saves lives.